My sister's first job, when she was still at school, was to fold up letters and put them into envelopes so they could go through the franking machine. While she worked, they would put the radio on, and she learned to recognize the call of the blackbird, repeating itself, repeating its mate, and repeating itself. She said they would never tire of playing the blackbird. And so she began to fold their whistles into her letters and have them franked, to keep them from going purplish on the paper. I later read in a book written in the 1980s that the blackbird and its mate whistle to one another to say that they are there, still, and that the meaning of the whistle is not in the shape or colour of the sound itself, but rather in the interim pause. The silence on the telegraph poles in between is their transmission. A silence combed thin by the filaments of shut beaks. The purring of those distinct silences I did not register until I was about 13 or 14, although it must have been troubling me throughout my childhood in Bala. Before the blackbirds began, I had hoped to find myself autistic to stop my eyes getting stuck, and I collected many books on the subject in case of familiarities. I could draw well, but only by rote, and kept myself safe from those things I found too tall or too long. I remember having a book about Layla and her corkscrew horses, and how I copied them into my jotter without once looking up from the books I'd spaced about on the kitchen table. I thought if I could keep them on the paper, then her drawings and my drawings would have come from the same horse, and our eyes would match our letters. When Layla was 8, she forgot how to draw with her eyes, and her pond stuck up round from her ribbons of grass just like mine did, and we had lowercase m's for birds. It was long after I stopped drawing horses that the collapse came, and because of problems with equity, we began to have trouble with food. My father told me that eating a stewed boot for Thanksgiving dinner is something that can happen to a hungry person. There are many ways to quiet desperation, he said, and if it is made of leather, there are worse things than a boot. After this, I would write lists of things and put them into orders for quiet desperation. I would write down candle, broom handle, telephone, sponge, hot water bottle, and other things I came upon, and Alma would too. And we would compare our orders. Alma said if she could do it slowly, she might be able to gnaw on a telephone as though it were a pen lid until it was chewy. And if she could fry it and eat it salted, she'd quite enjoy a natural sponge. But she would usually put candle last because of the waxiness. After a little while, we started to think that the things at the top of our lists were both house things and food things, and not really more one than the other. And as our game went on throughout our teenage years, the tops of our lists grew almost to the bottoms, until whole rooms tumbled, houses, trees, stars, into our quiet desperation. When I first spoke to Alma about the Chaplin film, she told me she'd seen her own film that afternoon of a boy sitting in the kitchen with cut-up bits of magazine on the table around him. On his plate, he had put a little shiny roast chicken with orange potatoes around it, a fish on an oval platter with its head still on, the parsley garnish on top, delicately perforated by his careful scissors. Three lamb chops spaced about near the flowers printed on the rim of his plate. Further along, a rounded bunch of green that was broccoli or spinach. A bed of spinach around two stuffed peppers topped with cheese. And an immaculate pavlova. Photographed from above, perfectly round and the centrepiece of his little mealtime. As he cut and pushed the white edges of paper about his plate, and needed a spoon because their whisper thinness would not accommodate the prongs of a fork. And as he put the pictures into his mouth to chew and soften, He was quiet. What Thelma described to me I found profoundly upsetting, and in no small part because it was she, once again, who had found while it was still alive, and I was left to copy her corkscrew story into my jotter without looking up. A feat of concentration that never satisfied me, and always left me with an empty feeling that returns to me even now, when I've made a cup of tea and left it about the house somewhere going cold. But the little boy made me sad too, and he troubled me during the in-between parts of the day, while I was in the shower and waiting at the level crossing, and while the tape in my Walkman was winding. I got him confused with his paper scraps. I imagined how careful he must have been with his filigree hair to cut it out for the film. And I wondered about his earlobes and eyelashes in case he cut into them or cut them clean off. And even if they came away neatly, mightn't they tear at any moment so thin? With the little boy so paper thin, I confused his body with his skin and couldn't keep track of his surface. What alarmed me most of all was the thought of the fine web joins between his paper fingers while he leafed through the magazines, holding his scissors ready. I imagined that either the scissors would put thick creases in him with their weight, or the pages would catch the skin of his hands and lengthen his fingers horribly with cannibal paper cuts. At other times I would find myself parceling up his little paper body in my head, turning him over and folding his legs up and his arms across him like an iron shirt. I balanced the fish, the parsley, the pavlova, all of his cutouts flatly over his little stomach and folded his limbs up around him like an envelope, like a child's game from the 1900s, ready for him to die because of his hunger. Sometimes I would be the little boy, with my head flapped down and my arms in, and I found that an upside-down skirt kept the foods in better than shorts and thin legs, which let the lamb chops through.
Here we find trapped, as if for our observation, a chain of small rodents. Strung together like a necklace, each clinging tightly to the tail of its brother in front, with a firm grip of its little jaws. We find them suspended in the concentric motions of a whirlpool, the water lapping over the matted fur of the smallest as he puffs small sprays of exertion, drifting under the wavelets, sinking. Here is a chain of small rodents. A chain composed of teeth and wet fur. A little conglomerate machine working at staying alive. The line the curious eye follows over this semi-submerged object, a sodden string of sausages, notes its components. Mouth, snout, black eyes, pointed ears, furry back, catching spray, tapering to thick, wet tail, crammed into mouth, snout, black eyes, pointed ears, furry back, catching spray, tapering to thick, wet tail, mouth, snout, black eyes, pointed ears, furry back, catching spray, tapering to thick, wet tail, and so on. The imagined submerged half looks like this. Jaws, throat, front paws paddling, wet underbelly bulging, relaxing to back legs paddling, creeping up to thick, wet tail, clamped by jaws, throat, front paws paddling, wet underbelly bulging, relaxing to back legs paddling, creeping up to thick, wet tail, clamped by jaws, throat, front paws paddling, wet underbelly bulging, relaxing to back legs paddling, creeping up to thick, wet tail. To lift them, dripping but intact, into another plane of observation. One notes the links as a mode of amplification. Whilst we observe a finite string diminishing in size from the mother, open bracket, front, close bracket, to the tiniest baby, open bracket, rear, close bracket. We are, in fact, experiencing a looping action inherent in sequence. This is repetition. To inhere in sequence, to mutate. And here the mutation spectacularly undoes its foundation. The links preserving not strength but the passage of imminent dissolution, and the smallest, though exerting all his effort physically, trembles from the amplified instability of all other links, magnified in his tiny frame, drifting under the wavelets, sinking.